This talk is a talk actually that started with the nature of discovery in physics, and I will talk about strategies which I think will enhance the probability of one's making a discovery. But then, in fact, I've added a lot to it, and so the present title, I think, is normally how advances in science are made, but I'll try to include bits of both of these talks. The pictures are my own, by the way. This was taken with a Linhof Master Technica 45, but with a digital scanning back, I should say. This is the Golden Gate Bridge, and this is San Francisco, just at sunset on January 28th, 2006. So starting this, I will illustrate the first of the three messages I wish to give you with, again, my own pictures. That is the Grand Canyon at sunset. And the first message is that those discoveries that most change the way we think about nature cannot be anticipated. How then are such discoveries made, and are there research strategies that can increase one's chances of making such a discovery? And of course, I must feel that the answer is yes, there are such strategies, and so I will try to talk to you about them, starting with a linked chain of discoveries and inventions, beginning with this man here, Heikki Kamerlionis. And of course, I think we all know that this is the 100th anniversary of the liquefaction of helium, so it's a very special time for me to be talking about him. Kamerlionis was actually in a competition with Dewar to see who could first liquefy the lightest and most inert of the atmospheric gases, and it looked like Dewar had won in something like 1897, I think, when he first liquefied hydrogen. He pumped on the vapor above the hydrogen liquid, and of course ultimately finding out that the hydrogen solidifies under its own vapor pressure at a temperature of about 14 Kelvin. At that point it looked like Dewar had won this competition, but already in 1895 they had found evidence for the existence of helium, of course coming from spectral lines from our sun, and ultimately Kamerlionis was able to acquire enough helium that he felt he could liquefy it. Now, today, in fact, I deal with hundreds of liters, and typically large facilities will have thousands of liquid liters of helium, but Kamerlionis' sample was about a liter of gas at standard temperature and pressure. So he succeeded in liquefying that, as I think we all know, in 1908, and then he did with his liquid helium exactly what Dewar had done with the hydrogen. He pumped on the vapor above the liquid, cooling the liquid down, looking for the point where liquid helium would solidify. And he eventually did this. He did this for two full years, finally reaching a temperature of 1.04 Kelvin, starting at 4.2 Kelvin. And in fact, the liquid helium never solidified. Eventually, of course, he had to give up on this experiment. Now, I personally have cooled helium down to 1/10,000th of a Kelvin, and it still remains very happily in a liquid state. And the reasons have to do with quantum mechanics, which was just being developed at the time that Kamerlionis was doing his experiments. But rather than giving up on this business, he looked around for some other interesting question of the day that he could answer with this wonderful cryostat that he developed. And people were arguing about what might happen to the conductivity of metals as the metal was cooled toward absolute zero. So there were two schools of thought. One was that if it was a very pure metal, as you cooled it down, the lattice vibrations due to thermal excitations would go away and the conduction electrons would go longer distances, meaning that slowly as you cooled down, the electrical resistance would drop toward zero. But the other school of thought suggested that instead the conduction electrons, which were free to roam about the interior of the metal, would recondense on the ions from which they had come. The system would become completely neutral and all electrical conductivity would cease. So the electrical resistance would rise toward infinity. So Kamerlionis gave his student. Now, I put the student's name up here, Gilles Holst. You may know who he is. But in fact, his name was not on any of Kamerlionis' papers. Camarillionis was not of the habit of putting his graduate students' names on the papers. So he gave Gilles Holst a very pure sample of mercury and told him to measure its electrical resistance with this cryostat down to the lowest temperatures they could get. And at first, the data are the green points. It looked like, in fact, the electrical resistance was slowly dropping toward zero, as expected. However, at a temperature of a little bit above 4.2 Kelvin, Gilles Holst found an essentially discontinuous drop in the apparent electrical resistance to a value which was less than 10 to the minus 5 ohms, which was the resolution of their apparatus. And it took Holst quite a bit to convince his mentor, Camarillionis, that a lead hadn't simply fallen off of the sample. But, of course, these were reproducible results. And this was, in fact, the first measurement, first observation of superconductivity, which I would say has continued to be an interest of considerable interest by physicists, both theorists and experimentalists alike, ever since that time. Now, of course, we have the high-temperature superconductors and all sorts of things which I guess man had never expected, even in the late 50s, that we would see things that we've seen today. So Camarillionis, of course, won the Nobel Prize for Physics in 1913 for his liquefaction of helium and for his measurements of condensed matter systems at low temperatures. And, of course, his graduate student did not share that Nobel Prize. But I should say, in fact, that Gilles Holst did exactly what his thesis advisor told him to do. And so probably, maybe he didn't deserve it. But, in fact, I think I'm very happy that I did my work in a different epoch. So let's look at the research strategies. First of all, use the best instrumentation available. In this case, Camarillionis had developed an entire new refrigeration process, which allowed him to look at nature in a very new and different realm. Don't reinvent, borrow technologies you can. And Dewar had invented the Dewar flask in order to allow him to liquefy hydrogen, and Camarillionis was very happy to use that new technology. Look into an unexplored region of the landscape, and even though people had gotten cold, that is, Dewar had gotten cold, no one had really bothered to look at the properties of solids and other condensed matter systems at very low temperatures. And this is a very important one, particularly for graduate students, I think, but in fact, for professional physicists as well. Failure might be an invitation to try something new. So rather than giving up when Camarillionis wasn't able to measure the point at which helium solidified, in fact, he tried something new and almost immediately found something which has been of interest to physicists ever since. In fact, for the next 15 years, Camarillionis was the only person that could reach these low temperatures. So if you wanted to study superconductivity, you had to come to Leiden, to Camarillionis' laboratory. And so literally hundreds of times, he must have cooled his liquid cryogen, the liquid helium itself, down through the temperature of 2.17 Kelvin, which, of course, is the point where helium-4 becomes a superfluid, a Bose condensation-like process, which is almost as dramatic as superconductivity. And in fact, at one point, Camarillionis wrote in his lab book that it appeared that the liquid stopped boiling at a temperature of about 2 degrees. But he never followed up on that. He never looked into why that might be the case. And so he missed the fact that his liquid cryogen was undergoing a very dramatic phase transition itself. So beware of subtle, unexplained behavior. Don't dismiss it. And I think that's good advice, but there is, of course, a limit to how much one can do. So no one has actually won a Nobel Prize for having discovered superfluidity in helium-4. People realized there was a phase transition there after a while, and it was this person, Peter Kapitza, who first showed that the viscosity of helium in the superfluid state was virtually zero, less than a nanopoise. And that happened in the bleak winter of 1937, actually. And it wasn't until 1978 that Kapitsa shared the Nobel Prize. But in fact, this was a very unusual prize because Kapitsa shared it with people whose work had nothing to do with superfluid helium. This was a split prize, and the people he shared the prize with are shown here. This is Arno Penzias and Robert Wilson, who, of course, discovered cosmic microwave background radiation. Now, I should tell you that for many years, Arno Penzias was my boss's boss's boss at AT&T Bell Laboratories, so I know him rather well. But let me tell you the story of their discovery, because, in fact, they were at AT&T Bell Laboratories. And Bell Laboratories had been doing a series of experiments using this very sophisticated microwave receiver. And the first of these projects was the Echo Satellite Project. And you have to be rather old to remember that one. It actually didn't inflate properly. And then Telstar Satellite Project. And when those experiments were over, AT&T gave this very high-tech piece of equipment to Penzias and Wilson to do astrophysics experiments. Now, you might wonder why a telecommunications company is interested in astrophysics. Darn it, I took that slide out. I just took it out. It turns out that in fact, the father of radio astrophysics was using a directional antenna and, in fact, discovered radio noise coming from the center of the Milky Way galaxy. I think that was in 1933. Sorry I took that slide out. But what is so high-tech about this antenna? First of all, in fact, it's a horn antenna, which means, in fact, it doesn't look at signals coming from terrestrial sources. And the second is, inside this little booth was the quietest microwave amplifier of its day. And that amplifier was thanks to this gentleman here, Charles Townes, who is still my neighbor across the bay at the other university in the Bay Area, UC Berkeley. And Charles Townes was very interested in doing high-resolution molecular spectroscopy, and it was for that reason that he invented the MASER, the microwave amplification by stimulated emission of radiation. So this is, in fact, the second version of that MASER, which was based on ammonia, molecular beam of ammonia molecules. This is Jim Gordon, who later had a long career at AT&T Bell Laboratories. But shortly after developing technology, Charles Townes realized that, in fact, if you passed a weak microwave signal through this active region, one, in fact, could amplify the signal without adding appreciable amounts of noise to it. And so, in fact, that gave rise to the traveling wave tube MASER amplifier. And there was such an amplifier, basically not using this kind of technology, but a doped sapphire rod cooled to liquid helium temperatures inside this shed here. So this is, in fact, their first data showing cosmic microwave background radiation, or what ended up being that. The date is May 20th, 1964. Now, because most of the audience here are young, I should tell you that back in the old days, data didn't come out and was processed by a computer. It was written onto a piece of a long roll of paper that was pulled past the pen. The pen would move back and forth depending upon what voltage was applied to this thing. So here, in fact, is the signal coming from the antenna. Now, something was added by Penzias and Wilson because they wanted to make absolute noise measurements of microwave sources. They put in a switch so that they could compare the signals coming in from the amplifier to signals of a black body radiating at 4.2 Kelvin. That's gave a signal that was very well known. And so here, in fact, they've switched what they call the cold load, and they're doing calibration sources. And their conclusion was, even though they pointed their microwave antenna at a place in the sky where there should have been no radio sources, they found there was an extra 3.3 Kelvin of radio noise coming in on their receiver. Now, so they went back then and looked at this high-tech piece of equipment they had, and what they found when they went up inside here was that the pigeons had been roosting inside their antenna. So they cleaned out the pigeon nests and mopped up the pigeon droppings and soldered a few corroded copper plates back in place, but nothing that they could do would make this extra noise go away. So one day, Arnold Penzias was talking to a Professor Burke up at MIT, and it really bothered him that they couldn't understand the origin of this noise. In fact, they found that it didn't, of course, depend upon where they pointed their antenna. And Burke suggested to Penzias that he should talk to Professor Robert Dickey at Princeton University, because Dickey had someone in his group named Peoples, a theorist, who had predicted that there might, in fact, be microwave radiation left over from the point in the expansion of the universe where matter had cooled enough so that electrons and protons would combine to form neutral hydrogen. At that point, in fact, radiation and matter decoupled from one another. I, of course, this was 1964. I was, I guess, a freshman at Caltech at that time. But in fact, I served on a national committee with one of the people that was at that time one of Robert Dickey's graduate students, David Wilkinson. And David Wilkinson told me what he heard, because he was in Dickey's office when that phone call came through. And Dickey was asking him questions: have you checked that it's isotropic over the sky, and have you done this and that? And the bottom line was, it was at the end, Dickey hangs up the phone and turns to the few of his members of his group who are in his office, and he says, "Gentlemen, we have been scooped." Because, in fact, Dickey was looking for this, but he was looking for it with a conventional tube amplifier system which had a noise temperature of 2,000 Kelvin. So it would have been extremely difficult for Dickey to actually find these signals, but it was extremely difficult, at least for Arnold Penzias, to ignore these signals. So let us talk about the research strategies. First of all, use the best technology available. And I think the key for this discovery, as far as Penzias and Wilson were concerned, was in fact this traveling wave tube parametric amplifier. Don't reinvent the wheel, borrow if possible. And of course, they borrowed almost everything except for this wonderful microwave switch that allowed them to compare signals coming in on the antenna to a known signal. Look into a region of parameter space that is unexplored. And I should say that these were the first absolute radio noise measurements of any sort that had ever been made from extraterrestrial sources. And then I would say this is extremely important for experimentalists: understand what your instrumentation is measuring. It would have been extremely easy for Penzias and Wilson to say, well, unknown noise, subtract off 3.3 Kelvin, and just gone ahead and made all of their measurements, and in which case they probably wouldn't have gotten the Nobel Prize. I don't know if Dickey would have or not, but anyway, so what's happened to this field? Well, this is COBE satellite data. You can see, in fact, that beautiful black body curve with a temperature of 2.725 Kelvin within 1,000th of a degree. However, if you look at this radiation over the sky, this is plotted in galactic coordinates, you see in one direction, in the direction the Earth is moving, in fact, it is a slightly higher temperature, slightly lower temperature in the other direction. This is just Doppler shifts. If you get rid of it, then what you see is the plane of the Milky Way galaxy, and I don't know how they get rid of this, but they do somehow. And what they're left with is this blotchy-looking signal. And these variations in temperature are few millionths of a degree. So they're very, very small. But in fact, the people that developed this satellite program found these to be reproducible and believed that these were due to fluctuations in the temperature which ultimately were interpreted as fluctuations in the density of the universe just 400,000 years after the Big Bang. So they are really one of the great windows that allow us to look at the universe at a really early epoch. This is WMAC. Data. The W, by the way, is for David Wilkinson. He was involved in this project. Sadly, he died before it was launched. That's the problem you always have if you're working on a NASA project. I'm going to get myself in trouble, I know. Okay, but anyway, this is spectacular stuff. So ultimately, the leaders of the COBE satellite project, John Mather and George Smoot, shared the 2006 Nobel Prize for Physics. Okay, so now I come to the second of the three messages I have, and that is that the process of advancing science often leads to inventions and technologies that directly benefit mankind. However, it is impossible to know where the advance might lie that might solve a problem facing mankind. That is to say, it's actually hard enough once you've made the advance to know where it might work, but in fact, if, in fact, you have the problem, knowing where the advance might come from, that's even harder. Anyway, let me give one example of this, and that is nuclear magnetic resonance. This is a technique that I use in almost all of my work. And it was developed in 1946 by Felix Bloch at Stanford University and Ed Purcell at Harvard University. So we like to think of Harvard as being the Stanford of the East. Well... we like to think of Stanford as being the Harvard of the West, actually, but even that, we get laughter. So what happened is just 6 years. They developed NMR in order to understand the distribution of charge in atomic nuclei. That's what it was all about. 6 years later, they are awarded the Nobel Prize for Physics, and I am quite confident that when they went to Stockholm, they would talk to reporters who would ask, what is NMR or what might it be good for? Because they did exactly the same thing to me. And helium-3 has absolutely, no known applications. So, in fact, I've asked many people at Stanford who knew Felix Bloch and many people at Harvard who've known Ed Purcell, who knew Ed Purcell, what their answers to that question was, and supposedly Felix Bloch, who was a bit of a curmudgeon, if any of you know him, knew him, said, damn little. and Ed Purcell, when asked NMR might be good for, said, well, perhaps one can use it to calibrate magnetic fields. So let's see what happened to NMR since 1952. Well, eventually people could develop homogeneous enough magnetic fields that if you looked at the protons in some organic molecule in solution, you would find that not all of these protons resonated at the same frequency. There would be shifts, which are typically a few parts per million, and you get triplets or quadruplets depending upon what the molecule was. And these were eventually understood to originate for chemical and spin shifts in these organic molecules. And at this point, NMR became a very important tool for particularly organic chemists. Beyond that, Richard Ernst ported Fourier transform spectroscopy to NMR. And he, working with Kurt Wuttrich, developed a technique called two-dimensional NMR, but these are two frequency dimensions, not spatial dimensions. So the idea is you tip this spin, for instance, and then you look at how that changed the frequency of this spin. And so that's contained in this kind of information. That gives you some idea as what this bond length is, because we know the magnitude of the moments on those spins. And so in 1991, Richard Ernst was awarded the Nobel Prize, not for physics, but for chemistry. But Kurt Wuttrich continued in his work and ultimately was able to determine the three-dimensional conformation of even simple proteins. This is the bovine pancreatic trypsin inhibitor, which is supposedly the protein whose structure is known the best. Now, the reason this was important, because one, of course, could do this by crystallizing the protein as well, it wasn't clear that the structure of the protein would be the same in its crystalline form as it would be in an aqueous solution. And so in 2002, Kurt Wuttrich was awarded the Nobel Prize again in chemistry, and here is Kurt Wuttrich receiving the Nobel Prize from King Carl Gustaf of Sweden. It's sort of interesting, as you go to later and later Nobel Prizes, they give you more information. After a while, you can get little video clips. Anyway, it's fun to go to the Nobel website, even if you don't have one yet. But we're really not done, because in fact, starting in about 1973 or 1972, depends on how you look at it, in fact, people began to realize that if you applied a magnetic field gradient across your sample, the static field had a gradient, then in fact, you would encode information about the position of the nuclei that were contributing to that signal, and you could do it by applying the gradient in three different directions. You could, in fact, then get a three-dimensional image of the sample providing the signal. And this is, in fact, a very healthy human knee. You can see a very healthy medial meniscus here. I've had both of my knees MRI'd. Neither one of them looks that good. Okay, that's a good-looking knee. So this started in 1972-73, and ultimately it developed to the point where it is now MRI is in most hospitals. And I'm kind of just curious, this is a very young audience, how many people in this audience have had part of their anatomy MRI'd? Pretty impressive, actually. That's pretty impressive. I'd say it must be 15-20%, something like that. Okay, so Paul Lauterbur and Peter Mansfield shared the Nobel Prize, not for physics nor for chemistry, but for physiology or medicine, for their developments in the field of NMR. And I dare say when, Paul Lauterbur visited Bell Laboratories, and I got to talk to him. Unfortunately, he's died. Now, Nobel laureates don't seem to hang around long. But we're really not done yet. I believe, in fact, there's a possibility for one more Nobel Prize for NMR, and that is Seiji Ogawa in the early 90s at AT&T Bell Laboratories began to realize that if you did NMR sequence, which was sensitive to the rate that the protons returned along the magnetic field, that you could image those regions in the brain which were processing information, because the change in the state of the hemoglobin changed the relaxation time for the nuclear spins. And so this is now called functional MRI. And in fact, it's really turning the field of psychology into from a social science into a natural science or a physical science. It's kind of having quite an impact, I think, and we'll see what happens. I'm predicting that one. I may not be alive when it happens, but who knows? Okay. So now I want to go on to talk about a specific discovery, and which is, of course, mine. What I found very quickly is if you talk about other people's discoveries and how chaotic the state was when they had found something that they didn't understand, in fact, that they looked a little bit, particularly if these guys had won Nobel Prizes, there were followers that didn't like that sort of thing. So I don't do that. I will only talk about my discovery, and I'll tell you right away, it happened while I was still a graduate student, but I don't think that has anything to do with it. We were completely clueless as to what we had discovered. So the interesting thing about this was that I almost feel that I spent my entire life waiting for this discovery to happen up to that point. I was preparing for that. I'd always been interested in doing experimental science. And when I was in high school, my chemistry teacher talked about research. And he said, doing an experiment is asking a question of nature. And nature has to answer your question, but her answers won't be what's in, what you wanted, but something else that needs further interpretation, so you have to do additional experiments then. And that is exactly what I did, starting in November of 1971 until I guess we were finally done in about July of 1972. So let me first say a little bit about the history of helium-3, because it's It's kind of interesting. It doesn't exist in sufficient natural abundance for anyone to have formed a bulk sample of pure helium-3. Instead, in fact, it results also, however, from the decay of tritium. Tritium decays to helium-3 with a half-life of 12.4 years. And so Los Alamos National Laboratory, they were trying after World War II to develop the hydrogen bomb, and they were having large amounts of tritium around. And there was a guy named Ed Hamill whose group was responsible for keeping the tritium pure. So he kept separating out the helium-3. And eventually they decided to measure the vapor pressure of helium-3 as a function of temperature. And so they did that, and they published it, I think, in 1949. And they actually said how large their sample was. And immediately after that, the Russians started doing similar experiments, but they never said how large their samples were. And I interviewed Ed Hamill over the phone. He was in his 80s. He said he reckoned that that was the first serious security leak at Los Alamos National Laboratory. So anyway, during the 50s, people started studying the normal state properties of helium-3. Helium-3 atoms have a net spin of 1/2, and that means, in fact, the atoms themselves, despite all their internal degrees of freedom, are Fermi particles. And in fact, one might expect that liquid helium-3, which exists to temperatures arbitrarily close to absolute zero, might exhibit the same sort of Fermi degeneracy as one sees in conduction electrons in metals, which in fact is the case. So the theory was worked out mostly by Lev Landau, and John Wheatley was the person that probably did the best experiments. In 1957, John Bardeen headed the group that explained the microscopic origins of superconductivity, and within 2 years, theorists began to realize that in fact some variation of that theory might lead to some sort of BCS condensation in other degenerate Fermi fluids as well. And the only two that were known were liquid helium-3 and the dense nuclear matter in neutron stars, which is very difficult to do experiments on neutron stars. It's hard to attach leads. Anyway, so this was the original prediction was the transition temperature would be 80 millidegrees. And this started a search, worldwide search, that lasted better part of a decade. And eventually, in 1965, John Wheatley had cooled helium-3 at saturated vapor pressure down to a temperature of 2 millidegrees and saw no superfluidity. And the theorists then said, well, we probably don't understand the interactions between helium-3 atoms. And so probably TC is going to be 50 microdegrees. No one knew at all how to get to those low temperatures, and so all searches for superfluid in helium-3 ceased. I became a graduate student in 1967, and I think the word on the street at that point was that superfluid in helium-3 was some aberration in the theorist's mind, and it wasn't really going to exist. However, there were interesting things going on in low-temperature physics. David Edwards at Ohio State had shown that liquid helium-3 would remain miscible in helium-4 superfluid to arbitrarily low temperatures, and Henry Hall in 65 realized that you could use that fact to develop the helium-3, helium-4 dilution refrigerator, which is probably the most commonly used temperature to, refrigerator to reach temperatures down to typically a few thousandths of a degree above absolute zero. So that's when I became a graduate student at Cornell University. And there were two talks in that first semester when I was at Cornell. One was on the helium-3, helium-4 dilution refrigerator, but the other was, in fact, by Bob Richardson about what he called Pomeranchuk's conjecture. Now, Isaac Pomeranchuk was a member of the Landau School, and he was actually mainly studied high-energy plasmas. But in fact, in 1949, when Hamill published his results, Pomeranchuk started thinking about the properties of liquid and solid helium-3 might be like. And he realized that in the solid, the nuclear magnetic moment is rather weak and the atoms are fairly well separated. So, in fact, you probably wouldn't expect the nuclear spins to order until some very low temperature, which he estimated would actually be 1/10 millionth of a Kelvin. ends up, it's really about 0.002 of a Kelvin for other reasons. And so the entropy would stay very high, whereas if you had Fermi degeneracy in the liquid, in fact, its entropy would drop linearly with temperature. So you end up with a very unusual situation where the liquid is more highly ordered than the solid. And then if you calculate the latent heat of solidification, it ends up being negative, which means that in order to solidify helium-3 at constant temperature, one has to add heat to the system. It's a very unusual system indeed. And so, in fact, one can use that as a refrigeration process. And here, this is the helium-3 melting curve. This is solid up here and liquid down here. And if you raise the pressure, and you can go along the melting curve to lower and lower temperatures, eventually converting all the liquid to solid, and then you'd come off the melting curve. This seemed like such a preposterous idea that no one tried it. It was proposed in 1950, and it wasn't until 1965 that one of Peter Kapitsa's students named Anufriev tried this in the Kapitsa Institute in Moscow. And he started at about 100 millidegrees and got down to a temperature of about 20 millidegrees, which wasn't really very cold because dilution refrigerators would go below that. But there were people in the West, including John Wheatley and my thesis advisor, Dave Lee, that felt that if you could do this process reversibly and isothermally, in fact, that you could, in fact, start with liquid helium-3 here and form solid deep into the ordered phase. And so the idea was then to use this process to study nuclear spin ordering in solid helium-3. And that was essentially what I joined the low-temperature group. A group to do. This is the Pomeranchuk cell that I actually designed my second year graduate study. Now, I should tell the students here that I actually designed this while lying in the hospital bed recovering from knee surgery. I could have watched sitcoms on television, but they were really bad back in those days. Or I could spend my time developing something that might be useful. So this, in fact, is the cell that was ultimately used in the discovery of superfluidity in helium-3. So the helium-3 is in this lower region here. It's in gold because it's kind of expensive, I guess. And to solidify it, you have to decrease the volume. So you push a metal bellows into this region using superfluid helium-4 as a hydraulic fluid in a larger bellow in the top. And then we attach this to a helium-3, helium-4 dilution refrigerator. And we measured the temperature by looking at the polarization of platinum-195 nuclei in a static magnetic field using NMR. And we measured the melting pressure using a very sophisticated capacitive pressure transducer. So this was the idea that I had at that time. Here is, in fact, some data where we're trying to use this. Now, I'm skipping a bit because, in fact, I was actually doing an experiment in the beginning of my fifth year graduate study, which looked very exciting. It was based on results from another laboratory that turned out to be completely wrong. And so what looked like a very big and exciting effect ended up being very difficult to see, measure, tiny effect. And so if only after some other graduate students took away the NMR magnet that I was using to do that experiment, did I do the experiment that, in fact, led to the discovery of superfluidity in helium-3. So basically, my question I wanted to answer was, how cold could this Pomeranchuk cell get? So now we didn't have a thermometer. The thermometers all fell out of thermal equilibrium with helium-3 at about 0.003 of a degree anyway. So I decided I should be able to use the melting pressure itself as a thermometer. We calibrated it down to about 2.7 millidegrees. And so here, in fact, the melting curve is rising. This time is increasing to the right, and pressure is increasing upward. As we compress liquid into solid, the system is cooling. Here, I rebalance the capacitance bridge that measures the pressure transducer's output. And in fact, it continues to cool. And then at this point, which I've labeled A, we saw a very abrupt decrease in the rate of cooling. And I was, of course, very unhappy to see this. I assumed that the metal bellows in the helium-3 region had run into some solid helium-3. We had no idea where it grew. And so I terminated this run. This was the day before Thanksgiving, 1971. But I decided I would let this apparatus pre-cool over the entire four-day academic holiday and try again the next Monday. I'd started at 22 millidegrees, but my dilution refrigerator would go down to 15 millidegrees. So I tried this experiment again the next Monday, and here I'm going a little bit faster, cool, 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 rebalance bridge, cool, cool, cool. And here it is again. In fact, the pressure of this kink had reproduced itself to 2 parts in 100,000. So it seemed extremely unlikely to me that this could have been a chance random heating event. It seemed far more likely that this was the signature of some highly reproducible phase transition inside this mixture of liquid and solid helium-3. So I let this thing continue cooling, and at a much lower temperature, probably about 1.5 millidegrees, we saw a very tiny drop in pressure. And we didn't know what to make of this. I very quickly checked to make sure the capacitance bridge was operating correctly. But in fact, ultimately, we found that both of these transitions were, in fact, reproducible. So I had discovered not just one, but two unexpected phase transitions in this mixture of liquid and solid helium-3. So the question is, how do you decide whether the transitions are in the liquid or in the solid? And it wasn't clear what to do. We really couldn't look at the solid or liquid helium-3 inside this thing. Temperatures were way too low. So I went to Michael Fisher, who was a theoretical chemist, and asked him how solid helium-3 should grow inside a Pomeranchuk cell. And I think after I explained to him what a Pomeranchuk cell was, he said, well, you have to worry about the surface tension energy between the liquid-solid interface, and that, of course, will make this a first-order phase transition. And so it probably would nucleate on solid surfaces inside your cell somewhere, and if you're lucky, maybe only two or three of those cases. So then I said, if that's correct, what can I do to differentiate the liquid and solid signals? So I decided that what I would do would be apply a gradient in my static magnetic field, so it was larger at the bottom than the top. And then if I applied a single RF frequency to this NMR tank circuit, in fact, only a very thin layer would be in resonance. And if I swept the frequency upward, this resonant layer would move downward. So I could plot out the NMR properties as a function of altitude in the cell. This is exactly, except it's CW NMR, the technique which is used to do MRI today. And in fact, I asked Paul Lauterbur when he visited Bell Laboratories if he had read my paper. And he said, yes, he read it when it came out, which was in 1972. And I didn't ask him. The next question was, did that influence your decision to start working on MRI, which was in 1973? So I really don't know. Unfortunately, he's dead too. Terrible. So I think Nobel laureates died because of this lecture circuit that they're on. Anyway, so here's the data. This is April 17th, 1972. And so now time is increasing to the left and pressure is increasing downward because you like to think of these as positive resonances. They're actually absorption peaks, so they really go downward. But so we go from low frequency to high frequency to low frequency, and there's all this structure in here. And this is the liquid signal, and it should be, in fact, flat across here, but in fact, it looks rather distorted. These are solid peaks, and there are two or three in there, exactly as Michael Fisher had suggested. So we go, as time is going on, the sample is cooling. This is the B transition right here. And so you can see the liquid signal is about the same, and then all of a sudden, the liquid signal has dropped by about a factor of two. Now, just except for this funny distortion, but I looked at that and said, why would the liquid drop? Okay, if you formed Cooper pairs, one member of the pair with it spin up and the other with the spin down, that's what you get in conventional superconductors. That would not contribute to the NMR signal. Of course, this is a first-order phase transition, but never mind that. Anyway, I wrote in my lab book that night at 2:40 in the morning. This is a very good time to make discoveries, by the way. Have discovered the BCS transition in liquid helium-3 tonight, and then I explain here what I just explained to you. This was unquestionably the most exciting moment of my life. Eventually, I felt I had to share this with someone, so I went around the basement of Clark Hall, the physics building at Cornell. There's always people there all hours of the day and night, except for this particular night. I was the only person. In desperation, I went up to the fifth floor to see if a theorist had fallen asleep at his desk. I was the only person in the entire physics building. So at 4 o'clock, I couldn't stand it any longer. I called up my thesis advisor. Luckily, he agreed with me that this was very strong evidence that the transition was in the liquid. And I always tell my graduate students they should not hesitate to call me up at 4 in the morning, but it better be good news. Which is to say, I don't want one of those calls, "Doug, the liquefier died, what do I do now?" Anyway, so let's talk about the strategies that allowed this discovery to occur. Well, first of all, utilize new technologies to view nature in a new from a new perspective or in a different realm. So I was really looking. It's interesting. People had looked at helium-3 at saturated vapor pressure down to 2 millidegrees. These transitions were actually, certainly the A transition, the higher temperature transition, is 2.5 millidegrees. But in fact, so I was working at melting pressure. In fact, this refrigeration technique forced me to work at melting pressure. Don't give up when things are going badly. When the graduate students took the NMR magnet away from me, that would have been a good time to warm up. This was clearly experiment was going nowhere and go camping in the Adirondack Mountains. But in fact, I stayed cold and I did something, and I'm here because of that. Spend a little bit of your time doing something different. Curiosity-driven research is fun, and it can be rewarding, and it usually doesn't take an awful lot of work. And this is for graduate students: avoid too many commitments. The demands of good research do not adhere to a schedule. I have frequently at Stanford, I have students that want to get involved in ballroom dancing or something like that, And I say, well, okay, you can do that, but you better not let that influence, you know, what you're doing in the laboratory. You know, I give you $1 million worth of equipment. You've got a few years to prove what you can do with it. What's more important to you, ballroom dancing or getting a job in physics? Well, sometimes they elect to do ballroom dancing anyway. Avoid too many commitments. And then this is another one. I'll talk about that later in a bit. But so then I left Bell Laboratories actually at Cornell in July of 72, and I showed up at Bell Laboratories in September of, actually it was November, September, must have been September of 1972, and it was a fantastic place to be. Doing the best research I could. I had some of the best theorists in the world there working with me. And eventually in 1977, Joe Burton was the director of the Physical Research Laboratory. He hauled me in his office and he said, "Ashraf, you've now been here 5 years and you've done nothing but study superfluidity in helium-3. And I got really nervous. I didn't like the tone of that at all. He said, "Don't you think it's time to try something else?" And I walked out of his office feeling absolutely crushed. But within probably an hour, I started feeling that an enormous weight had been lifted from my shoulders. More and more, I was doing incremental research. I was measuring numbers that were known to exist. We just didn't know what the value was. And Joe Burton had given me a hunting license to go out and look for entirely new science. And within 2 years, working with collaborators at Bell Laboratories, we essentially solved the problem of nuclear antiferromagnetic ordering in solid helium-3, actually determined the precise structure of the nuclei. It's something called He3U2D2. I don't have the picture in this PowerPoint presentation, but my wife was kind enough to give me as a birthday present, a license plate, He3U2D2. And I think absolutely no one looks at that and says, "That's a vanity license plate." Anyway, so that we did that work, and at the same time, Jerry Dolan and I discovered weak localization. So it's amazing, you know, if you're focused in on what you're doing, and you think it's the most important thing that you would have ever done or that you ever could do, but in fact, there's a lot of things out there that have never been seen, and it's really much more exciting to go out there and find those new things. So strategies, let me say, reflecting my Bell Labs experience, change is the subject of your research occasionally. It's a hard thing to do sometimes. After a while, we lose perspective as well as run out of ideas. Note the predictions of theorists, but don't trust them to be correct. Now, I get in some trouble by saying this, but I think what I say is actually very complimentary. Theorists have an incredibly good sense of where interesting physics lies. We can't expect them to get all the details correct. So you have to build flexibility into your experiments. And, you know, I think certainly the weak localization, no one had predicted that, at least in print. David Thallus predicted something which we were looking for and didn't see. We modified the experiment, and then we found weak localization. And then collaborate to add additional expertise. And it's always fun to collaborate with people that are your friends that know exactly the same things you do, but it's much better to collaborate with people whose skills complement those of your own. That's where you really have effective collaborations. And so after having had a lifetime of wonderful experience doing research and seeing things for the first time, it's not fair that I should be rewarded after stealing all of that fun part. But here I am receiving the Nobel Prize. And you notice, in fact, that I'm smiling. So anyway, so the last thing I want to tell you is that, in fact, all of this work depended on lots of other people. I guess it was Newton that said, "I have seen so far because I have stood on the shoulders of giants." And I don't know if they're giants, but in fact, you can look at some of the people. Without Bardeen, Cooper, and Schrieffer's theory of superconductivity, we wouldn't have been looking for superfluidity in helium-3. If we'd seen it, it wouldn't be understood. Anderson's interpretation of this theory in terms of helium-3, Pomeranchuk's cooling technique, David Edwards and Henry Hall's contributions to refrigeration, to dilution refrigerators, Ed Hamill's liquefaction of helium-3, Wheatley's and Landau's work understanding the normal state, Bloch and Purcell for their development of NMR, and I'm sure I could probably put a dozen other names on here. The fact is that advances in science are seldom made by individuals alone. The result from the progress of the scientific community, asking questions, developing new technologies to answer those questions, and sharing their results and their ideas with others. To have rapid progress, one must support physical research, scientific research broadly, and encourage scientists to interact with one another and to spend a bit of their time satisfying their own curiosities. That is how advances in science are made. Thank you.
So thanks a lot, Doug, for this insightful lecture based on a lot of personal experience. We have time for a few questions. You should use the microphone, which will be handed around, since this is being recorded.
Surely someone has a question to ask me. Ah, over there.
It's a little physical question.
That's okay. Nothing personal.
Not directly. Assuming you were 20 or 30 years again, what would you do your research on the next 10 or 20 years?
I guess I went into ultra-low temperature physics because it looked like there were new refrigeration technologies that held promise of allowing one to look at nature in a new or different realm. And I think my hopes were justified. I guess if I were starting all over again, I would look for new technologies that would allow me to look at nature in a new or different realm. And I don't know what that would be exactly, but certainly the trouble is that nowadays we have what's called the Bose-Einstein condensation of scientists all looking in the same area. So I think one would probably have to, it's kind of interesting, you don't want to work in an area where there is no one else working. At the same time, you also don't want to work in an area where there are too many people working. How you define that, I don't know. But I suppose right now nanophysics is quite exciting stuff, and my guess is that's probably where I would end up. But don't, I mean, if you go into that field, don't blame me. more questions? Comments? Yes.
Yeah, so you gave the theorists a hard time, but how did you collaborate with them?
I actually, when I was at Bell Laboratories, I think I co-authored at least, I know it's more than half a dozen papers with theorists. And so it depended on who it was. When I worked with Daniel Fisher and Mike Cross to understand spin ordering in solid helium 3, it was a fantastically rich collaboration. We would talk, I would tell them what I'd seen, and they suggested things that I might look for as well. And sometimes I'd see those things and sometimes I wouldn't. But and then, you know, there was one moment which is really classic. I was walking into Bell Labs, and I would hop in the car in the morning, and it was a half-hour drive. And so I had plenty of time to think about, you know, what it was that I was wanted to do or what I should do. And something was bothering me because I was growing these crystals of solid helium-3, and I wasn't seeing just one resonance peak, but I was seeing three resonance peaks. And the next smallest number was not four, it was six. And so I walked in, and Daniel Fisher was talking with Phil Anderson, both theorists. And I told him, this is really bugging me, and I don't understand. And I told him what I was bothered about. And Daniel Fisher says, aha! And he runs off, and an hour later, he comes down, and he realized, in fact, there must be exactly three domains, magnetic domains, in the ordered solid phase. And so then he predicted something. It's a cubic structure. So he predicted something about the sum of the frequency shifts of these three resonances. He was exactly correct. That was a fantastic moment. But, you know, really, I've had wonderful collaborations. Now, I must say, there was one time I was collaborating with Phil Anderson. Phil, you know, there you're collaborating. It's not collaborating with your equal. It's your superior. And so this was on something having to do, if you apply a very large magnetic field, the upspins pair before the downspins, and you see extra behavior. And so this paper got written, and we were co-authors, but all the way it was written, the tone was all Phil Anderson. You know, it was like trying to waltz with a hippopotamus or something like that.
I have one more question, yes? If I may. This afternoon, you told me a little story about the coffee and the cookies. And I wondered, the social environment for good collaborative research, how important is it? How does one construct that?
Yeah, it's interesting. At Cornell, we had every day that we had coffee and donuts at 4 in the afternoon. And people would run down and get those things, and frequently you would end up talking to people about what they were doing. And these conversations didn't take all that long, but you formed friends that way, and you sort of knew more than what was going on inside your own laboratory. And I think those sorts of things, of course, a lot of that happens now. People go to international conferences, and they meet people, and they have dinners, and they go out drinking and all sorts of bonding things that they do. These are very important, but of course it costs a lot more time than just meeting the people in your own institution. So I think both of them are important, and in fact I think they should be encouraged a lot more than they are. One of the problems I always have in the United States is if you want to do foreign travel on a grant, you have to either put it into the grant proposal, which is extremely difficult because when you write that damn proposal, the conference you want to go to hasn't even been planned yet. Or in fact, you have to get permission from the funding agency. And I personally think they ought to get rid of that. They ought to encourage people rather than discourage people to do foreign travel. Thank you. Any other? How about some nice young people? Were you all asleep? Ah.
I was just wondering what sort of advice you give to female physicists, for obvious reasons.
Yeah, well, I don't see that female physicists are very different from male physicists in terms of the physics that they do. There is this problem that young women that want to have children have to have them while they're young. No question about that. Men, of course, usually the... depends on who you've married. If you've married another physicist, then in fact, presumably you will both share in the child-rearing part of that. And I think you need to seek a partner where the marriage will be a partnership rather than where the woman has one set of responsibilities and the man has another set. Because I think this whole issue about two career families. And I think more and more of them are that way. And you know, my wife is a biochemist, and I like to think that we've had a very good marriage, which has allowed us both to do the things that we want to do besides being married. But otherwise, I think the days, it's interesting, everyone knows, of course, Jocelyn Bell, who did not share the prize for having discovered, what was it, pulsars? I think it was pulsars.
Quasars.
Tony Hughes. Anyway, and you know, I think that doesn't happen. It's unlikely. Rosalind Franklin is, of course, Rosalind Franklin was actually dead, unfortunately, before they gave the Nobel Prize. That happens a lot. So you have to live long enough. But I don't see any reason. I know some women who are doing very well in science. I think it's maybe a little bit easier if you're a theorist than experimentalist. But you know, I don't think you should choose to be a theorist because you're a woman. Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Oh, yes.
What do you think about collaboration with industry? Or is it better to be independent in fundamental research, or where are the benefits in this collaboration with industry?
Yeah, there are a lot of people in this room that can answer that question a lot better than me. One of them is sitting right there, I think. From my own perspective, I was at Bell Laboratories, which was industry, but the part of Bell Laboratories I was at was probably much closer to a university, so it doesn't count. I think if you're collaborating with industry doing basic science, you have to do something that in fact you can sell to a company as being something that is in their best interests. The trouble, in the United States there used to be IBM, RCA, General Electric, Bell Laboratories, all doing a fair amount of basic research. And ultimately, I think virtually everyone has concluded that while the basic research may be stimulating for the environment, in fact, that company that supports that research doesn't seem to gain any competitive advantage over this work, which is basically published in all the journals. And so there's very little basic research going on. I think this field where basic research and applied research are closest together is probably in biotechnology right now. And there, in fact, I think that it's pretty easy to make those collaborations. But it's certainly the sort of stuff I do, I would say there's zero probability. But if you're interested in nanotechnology, I think there's lots and lots of chances. So it depends on what you're working in. Now, if the government decides, okay, we don't have to fund any of this stuff, let industry decide what basic research will be done, I think that would be a complete disaster for the world. Okay, so I hope that won't happen, but we'll see. Depends a bit on who becomes president next year for the United States. One more. Okay.
I have a question about funding. It seems to me that funding is a little bit related to the previous question, going towards applied money. Also, the government want, at least where I am in Sweden, goes towards wanting science which is applied. And it also seems to me that, as you said, scientists are doing the same thing, and it goes towards big excellence centers where very many people are doing the same thing. Do you consider those sort of trends a problem, or is it something
which... Well, I think you know the answer to that. Yeah, I do consider it to be a problem, and I think it's... I think there's a kind of maybe a growing feeling that there really is less basic research to be discovered and understood, and what we need to do now is take all of this wonderful science that we know and learn how to apply it. And I think this is a somewhat compelling argument, but I first of all doubt that most of what is to be known is known today. And I do think that in the process of addressing physical research problems, one develops and will continue to develop new technologies, which I think have the potential to benefit mankind. If you look at how much development work is done worldwide in areas of microelectronics, biophysics, biochemistry, all of this stuff, it is an enormous number compared to the amount of money going into basic science. And the question is, you know, where are the trade-offs? Where should that boundary be? I think that working in basic science is, in fact, a good training for young people. It's on the other hand, if what you want to do is something which is I think very heavily engineering oriented, then probably you ought to go more in that direction. But that doesn't mean, in fact, that you can't be developing new technologies which will probe nature in new ways. So I think that we have gone further than we should, and I think one of the arguments that the funding agents of the United States have used why we should support less basic science is that industry seems less interested in basic science. But I think we understand the reason for that, and that reason is not the reason that should make the funding agencies say that we won't support it. So I don't know what's going to happen in the future, but I share your concern. Thank you.